Thanks for tuning in for the July 27th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Joseph Schrager explains how the surgical approach used for a thymectomy may lead to differences in the rate of complete stable remission in patients with myasthenia gravis.
This is Stacey Clardy, and today I'm speaking with Joe Schrager. He's a CT surgeon, actually the chief of thoracic surgery at Stanford. He's the author of a paper in this week's issue of Neurology titled Impact of the Surgical Approach to Thymectomy Upon Complete Stable Remission Rates in Myasthenia Gravis, a Meta-Analysis. I was excited to see this paper come across the title list for the journal this week because this is an issue that's coming up more in practice. We now have the strong data that thymectomy is beneficial in select myasthenia gravis patients, but I do wonder about the ability of some myasthenia patients to recover from what can be a rigorous surgery. And this paper begins to broach the topic of how these thymectomies should be performed. So before we talk about surgical approach, just to update for our listeners, you can get up to speed on the optimal management of myasthenia by taking a listen to the January 20th podcast, where we did an update on management of MG with Pushpa Narayana Swami. And you can specifically hear all the details about the thymectomy trial in MG by listening to the podcast with Gil Wolf and Ted Burns from July 15th, 2019. And we also have a bunch of neurology minutes that focus on all sorts of pearls in myasthenia. You can find them by just searching the keyword myasthenia on the Neurology Minute webpage, or I prefer to do it on my mobile. You just go to your podcast library and search myasthenia. But back to this study, Joe and his group set out to determine whether the available operative techniques for thymectomy in MG resulted in differences in the chances of ultimately attaining a complete stable remission, which of course is the goal. And they did this by performing a meta-analysis of comparative studies of surgical approaches to thymectomy. Joe, thanks for doing the work to investigate this question and for joining us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
So can you first walk us through, you know, for the non-surgeon, I haven't been in an OR in a long time. Many of us have not been in the OR. So when our colleagues in CT surgery set out to perform a thymectomy, what are their options and what are the approaches they're considering?
Okay, so the classic approach is through a median sternotomy, just like you would have heart surgery through. And, you know, that's been done sort of since the 40s when people started to think that a thymectomy was a good thing for myasthenia gravis. A fellow named Jaretsky at Columbia in the 70s devised what he called a maximal transsternal and transcervical thymectomy, where he added a neck incision to the sternotomy, and he got more aggressive than people had ever been before, really taking out every bit of fat or thymic tissue, because you can't really tell fat and thymic tissue apart, like grossly, when you're doing an operation visually. So he devised this operation where you take out every bit of the material. Most people who do a sternotomy today do what's called an extended transsternal thymectomy. And extended means to take everything between the phrenic nerves and then the upper thymic horns that extend into the neck, but not every bit of fat the way Jaretsky described it. Because when you take every little bit of fat, you're going to have more complications. The operation takes much longer, so the patient's lying on the bed longer and more likely to get a DVT or something like that. More, you know, recurrent laryngeal nerve injuries, probably an occasional chylothorax, you know, or leak from the thoracic duct. So anyway, people sort of came down to it, what we call an extended thymectomy. Now, you know, with the move to minimally invasive approaches, kind of in the 90s and 2000s, four other approaches started to be tried and are now still done by lots of people. That would be a VATS approach, or video-assisted thoracic surgical approach, which means small incisions, usually three or four small incisions on one or both sides of the chest and getting at the thymus that way. Robotic, which is essentially the same thing as VATS, but using a robot that some people feel gives them finer control of what they're doing. Transcervical approaches through an incision at the base of the neck, and the kind of modern transcervical approach puts this sternal lifting retractor under the top of the sternum, and you sort of hang the patient from their sternum and then look in from the top past the patient's face to be working under the sternum. And many people put a video camera in to do that operation. I do that as well. And then subxiphoid approach is sort of the opposite of a transcervical approach, where you come from the bottom and lift up the sternum at the bottom edge near the xiphoid process. So you can see that it's sort of a dealer's choice with lots of different options. And the concern has been, can you really do an extended thymectomy, that is, remove all of the fat and thymic tissue between the phrenic nerves and the upper horn by one of these or all of these minimally invasive approaches? You know, the concern was that people maybe aren't getting as much tissue, are compromising the actual operation in order to do something minimally invasive.
Wow, that's a great explanation. I had no idea how many options there were. And I see your point here. So really the question is, when you're talking to a patient about this, on the surface of it, they're going to opt for the least invasive approach that has the fastest recovery. But the question is, are we sacrificing actual remission for a less invasive surgery up front? So what did you find? Are the outcomes similar or no? Tell us about what all these studies pulled together showed.
Well, first I should say, certainly the recovery is easier from pretty much any of these minimally invasive approaches. So that's not really in question. The hospital stay is shorter, the pain is reduced, and getting back to normal activities is sooner. On the other hand, a sternotomy is not a total disaster. I mean, you know, maybe from a medical doctor point of view, a sternotomy sounds really horrible, but...
Right. But these are done. They've been done. You guys have great experience.
But they've been done for 50 years. The complication rates are fairly low. You know, the downside is it takes 3 or 4 weeks more to get back to your usual activities. And there's that 1% disaster of getting a sternal wound infection. When the sternal bone gets infected, it's a real problem. So it's certainly nice to avoid that. But I don't want to say that a sternotomy is a complete disaster. So what we found is that there is no significant difference between, I should say we included 12 studies that had 1,600 patients, and we only included studies that did a comparison of one approach to another approach. And only 12 studies met sort of very stringent criteria for entry. And what we found is there's no significant difference between extended VATS or extended robotic thymectomy and extended transsternal thymectomy in terms of the rate of complete stable remission. And there's no difference between extended subxiphoid thymectomy and extended transsternal thymectomy. From my personal point of view, unfortunately, there was not enough data to comment on extended transcervical, which is kind of my go-to approach, versus transsternal. The only significant difference we did find between any of these minimally invasive approaches that we had enough data to study and transsternal was when you compared the old, now obsolete, basic transcervical thymectomy to transsternal thymectomy. So basic means they basically just went in without a sternal retractor to lift up the sternum. They could barely see, and they sort of put a finger into the anterior mediastinum and probably tore out 3/4 of the intracapsular thymus. They didn't get any of the extracapsular stuff that Jaretsky proved in the 1970s, you know, does exist. These little seeds of sort of thymic tissue that are in the fat surrounding the thymus and even up into the neck outside of the capsule.
But you're confident no one's doing that procedure anymore, right?
I am confident no one's doing that anymore. I think people are doing transcervical thymectomies in several places, though less popular, I think, now than the robot or VATS, which have really taken off. And I think the people who do it have a committed sort of thymic practice and have figured out how to do a real extended operation using the substernal retractor and a video camera.
So it gets a bit wordy, all these descriptors for the surgeries. I know you broke them down for us.
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. You know, it's a little complicated.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is, tell me if I'm wrong here, really these minimally invasive approaches, we can be confident that they're going to...
Absolutely. I mean, I would summarize it by saying that every minimally invasive approach that we have enough data on has equivalent outcomes to extended transsternal thymectomy.
Fantastic. And you did make a point too, and I don't want to overlook this. It was long-term outcomes you were looking at too, right? Like we're talking about 10 years?
So we insisted that the studies have at least 3-year mean follow-up because, you know, as neurologists know, when you have remissions, it doesn't happen immediately after the surgery. It tends to happen gradually over the course of years. And we looked at all the time points that were available in the studies, and this was true all the way out to 10 years.
Great. You take the upfront discomfort of a surgery and you get a long-term payoff. So that's important. Something not in your paper, but you know, while I have you on the phone, something we don't talk about, but as a neurologist, we think about. So when I'm counseling the patient, when I'm discussing thymectomy, it sounds like I can confidently say to them, based on the data that we have, which admittedly is not a head-to-head prospective study, but that we think the minimally invasive approaches will minimize recovery time and upfront risks, but also give the same or quite similar benefit. But, you know, something in the back of my mind is always, how many thymectomies should a CT surgeon be doing a year to be considered experienced, right? I think we're always taught the more specific surgeries a surgeon does, that's probably who you want to go to. I want the best for my patients. So how do I get at that? You know, we have an international listenership. Give us pointers on how to get our patients access to the best care.
It's a tough question, you know. I mean, my sort of gut response is a patient shouldn't feel bad about asking a surgeon how many operations they do. You know, if the surgeon doesn't do a lot of the operation and is not an expert, then that will show in his or her answer. And I think a surgeon who does have the experience is very happy to tell the patient about it. And that can give people a lot of confidence in what they're embarking on from the patient's and referring doctor's point of view. So ask.
Good advice.
I would say that, you know, what really matters is not so much the surgical approach, but the commitment of the surgeon, the understanding of the surgeon of myasthenia, and that he has to do a real extended thymectomy and get all of that fatty tissue. And that's going to come from somebody probably who has a real interest in thymic disease. So I would look for people who publish about thymectomy for myasthenia gravis. If they publish it, they certainly have an interest in it, presumably understand the topic and understand that they need to expend the effort to get that extra tissue out from whatever approach they're doing. You know, so I think it would be great to look for somebody who publishes. It's great to ask them. I think if you're not doing 10 operations a year for myasthenia, that's too few. I think if you're doing 10, you know, that means over a few years, you've got a lot of experience. It's obviously a fairly rare disease. So 10 may sound like a low number, but I don't think there are that many surgeons who do 10 myasthenia operations a year.
Reasonable. And what you've told me is even if I can't get access to that surgeon, I now have some talking points. There's always accessibility issues, but I have talking points to say to my surgeon, you know, it's absolutely crucial that you get me as much of the thymus as possible. Okay. So that's helpful.
Yeah. Are you doing a true extended thymectomy?
Perfect.
Which is really the question.
I've got the language now. Is it reasonable to speculate that if we can get great benefit from increasingly minimally invasive approaches, we might be able to offer this to an extended age range of myasthenia patients who weren't as well studied in the trials? Is that something you've heard discussed or thought about?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. Certainly, any patient gets less of a setback, as we mentioned, from these minimally invasive approaches. And so in an older person where that's more important, you know, and a sicker person, right, where that's more important, somebody who has really bad myasthenia, you can sort of get away with doing the operation with very low complication rate. I know I'm seeing more older myasthenics now than I did. Obviously, the trial, the MGTX trial, didn't study older patients. They had to be under 65. I guess that's debatable whether under 65 is older, but it only included people under 65. Certainly, we're seeing more patients across the age range.
Okay, that's helpful. So anything else, you really dug into the literature, anything else we should be thinking about that might impact our patients in clinic based on this deep dive into the literature?
Well, I think that it's very clear from the literature, you know, before the MGTX trial, that if you do a thymectomy as close as possible to the onset of disease, they have a better outcome. So I think it's important to refer people early for thymectomy. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's worth saying that it's sort of traditionally ocular myasthenia. People don't refer for thymectomy, even though, you know, it's often chronic and doesn't get better. The results are actually best in ocular patients in terms of having a complete remission. And with the minimally invasive approaches, I think it becomes more reasonable, you know, to do a thymectomy in somebody who has less severe disease.
So the ocular patients have not been studied well. So that's probably an area where we do need to look at that, because it certainly does affect quality of life, you know, not being able to see, not being able to drive, being concerned you can't drive if it acts up on you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty bad. Some people have bad ocular disease. It's quite impactful.
So that brings me to my next question. You know, are you planning anything in the future for this to address prospectively? Anything in the works you're aware of?
So, you know, there's been a lot of talk about doing a prospective surgical trial that randomizes to some sort of minimally invasive approach, probably VATS or robotic, because they're the most popular, versus sternotomy, because that's the obvious question. You know, you've got the MGTX now that gives you really strong data that a lot of people should have a thymectomy. You know, now it'd be great to really prove beyond a meta-analysis that the minimally invasive approaches are as good. But, you know, it's very hard to organize a surgical trial, especially one when you randomize from a minimally invasive approach to a traditional approach, because patients don't want to be randomized. They all want the minimally invasive approach.
Right. Yeah. And to your point, right, I suppose you're telling us, right, if you had to get a thymectomy tomorrow, Remind me now, what approach would you go for?
If I had to get a thymectomy tomorrow, I would go to an experienced thymic surgeon who publishes about thymectomy for myasthenia and let him or her do whatever approach he or she is most comfortable with. I think it's basically the commitment of the surgeon and the experience of the surgeon with an approach. Generally, that's going to be a VATS or robotic approach, but there are a few people who do a really good transcervical or subxiphoid approach.
Right. And so I hear you saying that, and that probably would be an additional challenge to doing the surgical trial, especially if you mandated the approach that the surgeon uses versus let them do the one that they have experience with.
For sure.
Well, thank you, Joe, for talking about your findings. I feel more knowledgeable about thymectomy and its role in myasthenia and a little better prepared to discuss this with my patients and their surgeons and advocate for the best approach for their care, thanks to what I've learned today.
My pleasure.
And again, for the listeners, the article is in Neurology and it's titled Impact of the Surgical Approach to Thymectomy Upon Complete Stable Remission Rates in Myasthenia Gravis, a Meta-Analysis.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article describing the features of patients with below concentric sclerosis, as well as a study in which a deep learning system is developed to differentiate mild or moderate from severe papilledema on retinal photographs. Take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.